Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, welcome to another episode. I'm Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins, and my partner Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gel is going to take over the reins here in just a second. But before we get to Doug, have you ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors on social media? Well, guess what? Your wait's over, because that same artificial intelligence that's used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, that's now at your fingertips. The Buzz Index, which is licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, gives you a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't use surveys. They don't guess. In fact, recent academic studies have shown that sentiment can influence asset price movements in the short, medium term. Sentiment has predictive capabilities, and that's what the Buzz Index does. They look at the 75 stocks that have the most bullish scores when it comes to sentiment online, and they invest in those companies. Invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And a disclaimer, I own the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you, but got to tell you that. All right. And here he is, the man of the hour, the man of the week, Doug Goldstein.
Okay, I'm very excited to be talking today with Mihir Desai, who is a professor of finance at Harvard Business School and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's got a new book out called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. Mihir, I have to tell you, this is not really an overlap that a lot of people talk about, humanity and Wall Street. Tell me what you're thinking there.
Well, exactly right. You know, I think most people think the title is a little bit of an oxymoron, like a contradiction in terms. But that's in fact the whole point, which is there's a lot more tying together wisdom and finance than you would think about. The goal of the book is to demystify finance and to hopefully rehabilitate it. So demystify it is in the sense that many people find finance intimidating and they kind of find the ideas a little hard to access. So the idea in the book is you get all the big ideas of finance, but only through stories. So no equations and graphs, nothing intimidating as a way into the ideas. And then second, you know, I think chunks of finance are broken. And so the way to hopefully fix it is to make the people who participate in it look at their work through a moral lens. And that's what humanities do. That's what they're good at. They're good at making us understand issues through a moral lens.
So, explain what that means when you said chunks of finance are broken. What are we talking about there?
Yeah, so I think the finance industry, 10 years after the financial crisis, remains problematic. There's a lot of value extraction going on as opposed to value creation. I think that's a problem. And so we haven't really fully come to terms with that. And I think, you know, regulation has helped a little bit. You know, outrage has maybe helped people feel a little bit better. But the reality is the industry still has a long way to go. And I think instead of looking at spreadsheets and screens, I want people in finance to really think hard about what they're doing and the human dimension of it. And that's what the humanities do.
You know, finance is a very big world. From my standpoint, I just want to tell you about my day job. In real life, I am a personal financial advisor. I only get to do the radio gig once or twice a week. A lot of what I do personally is I work with people, and I like your model of telling stories, and I try to listen to what their story is and help them to figure out how can they come to a fine conclusion of their story eventually and build a portfolio that makes sense. When you're talking about finance, are you not talking about this kind of world, but you're talking about kind of like the too big to fail banks?
So I'm talking about both worlds, right? So they intersect. So there are these kind of, there's a big bad world of finance, which is large financial institutions. And then there's the microfinance, right? Which is in our lives and our retirement savings and all the things you help, you know, your clients with. But they're linked because people use those big financial institutions in all kinds of ways. And those are actually kind of very tightly linked. So, you know, my goal is to make the big financial institutions and the big players in finance behave better, but also restore the credibility for people like your clients. So they don't view finance, you know, with quite the skepticism that they might now. I'm not sure if you find that, but a lot of people here in the US at least kind of view a lot of people in finance and a lot of financial institutions with a great deal of skepticism.
Yeah, I hear that. But I wonder if the guy on the street really feels that he's getting bad service, for example, at the counter of the bank. And so that's how he feels. Or they're, you know, they're computerizing everything so he can't even get a meeting with a branch manager if he needs a loan or something like that. as opposed to saying something like, well, we know that the big banks, you know, tried to push through regulations which would allow them to continue doing all sorts of complex trading strategies, knowing that at the end of the day, if they didn't work out and they needed a bailout, then the FDIC would come along and, you know, or the government as a, you know, on its own would come along and make everything better. What part of it, of the world of finance are normal people really worried about?
Well, I think it depends on, you know, what people's exposure to the financial crisis was. But I mean, in short, I think 10 years later, people are still licking their wounds about what happened. Certainly in the U.S., there's a sense that, you know, did we learn anything really from that really dramatic episode? And, you know, we're still living with the consequences of that dramatic episode. So I take your point, which is, you know, obviously most people are concerned with their day-to-day lives. That's really what they experience in terms of finance. But first, I think there are these macro issues which are still hurting people. And then second, you know, even at the micro level, you know, I think with things like overdraft fees or the inability to kind of maybe get the loans or the feeling that your loans are kind of very burdensome, certainly in the student loan setting, that gives rise to a lot of skepticism about finance, I think even at the micro level.
We're speaking with Mihir Desai, who is a professor of finance at Harvard Business School. He also teaches at the law school. He recently came out with a book called The Wisdom of Finance. Mihir has been talking to us about the idea of trying to understand the financial world through stories, not a lot of, as you said, equations and graphs, just tell people what's really going on, and that they should realize that the world of finance is approachable if you understand a little bit more about it. One of the concerns, Mihir, that I've discovered is that it seems that as people are feeling the government is more and more coming in and trying to regulate and regulate, the people say, well, you know, I don't have to worry about it. The government will take care of that. And as a result, it seems to me that a lot of individuals maybe didn't learn their lessons from the crash of 10 years ago. And, you know, they're out there taking on more debt. And my guess is that more and more people are going to take on mortgages that they can't afford, or they'll take on adjustable rate mortgages, which as soon as rates go up are going to really devastate them. And they're just not even learning on their own. Is there a way to educate normal people just to be responsible for their own finances?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, right? Which is, and this is, I think, in part, you know, why are people ignorant about it? And part of the story is because we just do such a terrible job with financial literacy at the primary and the K-12 level. We should be doing much more than we currently do. And then the second reason why is because I think people genuinely do find it intimidating, right? And in part, the reason for that is people in finance like to intimidate you, and they kind of think these ideas are really tough. A good example is debt. You know, people make typically one of two big mistakes. You know, one mistake they often make is debt is bad. All debt is bad. I should never use it, which is a mistake because debt can be wonderful. It can allow you to access opportunities that you wouldn't be able to access otherwise, like an education or a home you couldn't otherwise afford. At the same time, if you take on debt, it's a very, very serious commitment. So people are making both those mistakes. Some people are ignoring the possibilities afforded by debt, and then others are actually not taking it seriously enough. So in the book, I use a variety of ways to think about that are more, you know, commonsensical. So for example, in debt, I talk about leverage and why in finance it's comparable to the way you think about commitments in your life. You know, which is commitments in your life actually allow you to experience things you wouldn't be able to experience otherwise, which is the great part of debt. And then secondly, if you break those commitments, you renege to people or to companies or organizations, it has really serious consequences. So kind of by mapping it to commitments as a way to think about what it is in your life, that can be a powerful way for people to understand both why it's great to take on debt and why it's great not to take on too much.
Is this a commitment like marriage? In other words, is that what you're comparing it to?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, in fact, like, let's just, you know, in part in the book, I use The Merchant of Venice. Part of what they do in that play is try to suggest that nominally it's about debt, but it's really about commitments. And it's about how people fashion their commitments to each other and how that allows them to do things that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. Marriage, kids, and being embedded in a large organization, all those things.
It's sort of interesting because if you take a step back and look at, I mean, not to philosophize too much, but where society is coming and how these institutions that maybe we grew up on that seemed a little more holy at a time, like marriage and family, are less and less important. Maybe this is going at in parallel with the fact that people simply are not able to see that as a real parallel to something like debt, because as it's actually an interesting comparison you're making, that both of them give you a commitment. Either you're committed to your spouse or you're committed to paying off a loan. But if people already are not so interested in being committed to anyone or anything, then how are they going to be committed to paying back a loan?
that's fair enough. But I think one of the things we realize is that actually commitments are spectacular, right? They access, I mean, the best example is kids. It's like the biggest commitment in the world, but you get access to an experience you would never be able to have otherwise. And in a way, the book has all these, you know, parallels laid out. You know, there's a chapter called No Romance Without Finance, which is all about, you know, marriage and the implications of mergers and finance for marriages. There's a chapter on commitments. You know, the corporate governance chapter is about the principal agent problem and uses Mel Brooks and the producers. So it's got like this big mishmash of things from the humanities and culture to explain all these big ideas in finance so that people will kind of think about it in a different way.
All right. Mihir, this is fascinating, actually. I think a lot of people should spend a little time reading this book just to get a different view of finance. I know that the listeners to the show are probably people who are already interested, but teaching yourself and your family and your kids about finance, if it doesn't work one way, you can always try another. So in the last few seconds, just tell us, how can people actually find you, find your work, find your book?
Yeah, so I'm on the web, and my homepage is mihirdesai.org, as well as on Twitter at @desaimihira. And of course, the book is available on Amazon and lots of other places.
Okay, we will put links to all of that at the show notes of today's show. Mihir Desai, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Doug. Thanks.
And before we get to our panel discussion, if you've ever wondered if you can take advantage of some of the people talking about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, investing online, well, guess what? That same artificial intelligence that some of the most sophisticated hedge funds use, you can use it too, and it's called the Buzz Index. The way the Buzz Index works is they target the most mentioned large company U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation gets, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on their proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks that have the most bullish score, those get included in the index. Each month, the buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and then they rebalance. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. I like especially the Buzz Index newsletter, the buzz that tells me not only when they rebalance, but also just gives me insights to what's going on online and social media land when it comes to investments. And now let's get to our panel discussion. Doug Goldstein, great interview, man.
Hey, Joe, thanks so much. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm fantastic now that I'm talking to you.
We got the whole team here today, the whole lineup. Miranda Marquette, you there?
Yeah, I'm here back from FinCon and ready to partay with the Money Tree crew.
Yeah, that was a great episode you did with Joe at FinCon. Hey, Linda, how is it going?
I'm good. Nice to be back. Have the group together again.
Oh, yeah. We're bad. I mean, and by bad, I mean good. So, Miranda, I was thinking about something that our guest said today, because you are a real storyteller. You're a writer in part of your life, as a part of, other than when you're not on the Money Tree Investment Podcast. One of the things that a lot of people like to do is they use stories in order to teach ideas, which I kind of support. But I wonder sometimes when you're teaching people about financial practice, is it a good idea to use stories and metaphors, or is that too kind of wishy-washy, since, you know, ultimately finance is a numbers game?
Yeah, so it's funny you should ask me that, because I went into journalism because I am a non-creative nonfiction writer. I like the numbers. I like that stuff, but people aren't engaged by the numbers. You throw numbers at them, their eyes gloss over, and they don't learn anything anyway. The reality is people connect to stories. They connect to those feelings, and that can help them take stock of the situation. It can also help them say, hey, this person has a similar story to mine beyond the numbers. I feel those feelings, I understand those feelings. Maybe there's hope for me. Maybe I can make these changes to my financial situation. Now, stories aren't the be all and end all, but at the same time, they can help people make that connection. They can help people take that next step, because I mean, and they've done studies about this. If you show somebody facts against their belief, they double down on their belief. Even if the facts and the numbers and everything else prove them wrong, they double down on their belief. They double down on what they know. And, you know, and then I think it was Mark Twain that talked about, you know, it's what you know for sure ain't true that is what trips you up. And when you're looking at finances, a lot of the time, you know things, you feel things. It's very emotional. We like to say, oh, money is a numbers game. No, it's not. I mean, sit down and look at how you feel when you look at your checkbook balance. Look at how you feel, you know, look at how you feel when you spend money on a shopping spree and you're getting that lovely shopping therapy. It's feelings. And as much as numbers really, you know, dictate the end result and how much you actually have in hand, the reality of this situation is a lot of it is still feelings.
Mm-hmm. Linda, how about you? When you teach on Be Wealthy and Smart, a large part of what you do is explain to people how to become better investors. Are you kind of a storyteller or do you just get down to facts? Just the facts, ma'am.
I think that the story is very important. And actually, I'm currently writing a book and putting stories into my book, which is really important because what I've run across, especially with women, is they tell me, I'm not good at math. Does that mean I can't be good with money? When I first heard that, it really surprised me, but I kept hearing it over and over and over again. And so apparently many women feel that way, but there is a component to investing that's just like shopping in a sense. When we're looking at, you know, what do we like? What is the price we're buying it at? What's the value? What's the quality? All those kind of things. And so there's a real, I think, qualitative part of investing. It's not just quantitative.
Joe, do you think that people being good at math is actually useful in making them better investors?
No, I don't think they do at all. And I think that stories lead people to the necessary math that they need. I think in terms of stories and in terms of analogies, and an analogy I have for your question, Doug, is that I really like board games. And there are people that create board games that try to teach things, and those board games always suck.
But hey, what about Monopoly?
Monopoly.
One of my favorites.
Monopoly teaches you terrible lessons.
Oh, Monopoly is so painful. Yeah, Monopoly is we all lose in the end to the one greedy person. No.
Well, no, but I mean,
how you sound like Miranda.
No, Monopoly. Right. No, but Monopoly has a new thing. My brother and sister actually bought a game for my son for his birthday a couple years ago, and it was electronic banking version. And it comes with a little card reader. It comes with a way for you to like use a credit card thing, and it comes with like huge, massive numbers. I guess you can learn how to get into a lot of debt with this game.
Right.
It was insane. Anyway, go on, Joe. I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's fine. But as an example, there's a new game out this year that I'm really interested in. I think I'm going to play it in the next week called Transatlantic. And it's about the early days of these ocean steamers. And the game, from all the rules that I've read and everything, it gives you the names of a few of the people that built these ships and these shipping lines. But it doesn't really get too much into the history. But you know what I find when I play games that are really fun like this one? Next thing you know, I'm digging into that history because first I have to enjoy what I'm doing and then I dig in. So I think sometimes we spend a lot of time trying to teach people about money and that turns them off. Where if we tell money stories that are fun and interesting, people then go learn on their own, like I'm going to do with this, you know, early 1900s transatlantic stuff.
Yeah, I just want to say too, you know, the book Think and Grow Rich, which is the closest thing we have to an official book on building wealth. It was, of course, commissioned to be written about the wealthy people of their day. And that book is all stories. I mean, it's all stories about how someone started with nothing and then became very, very wealthy. So I think that is sort of a legacy of talking about investing, money, wealth building, business, all kinds of different aspects. And that's, you know, just something to think about.
Yeah. And I think that the people who are good at managing money, it's not that they're any better at adding or subtracting or multiplying than the next guy. It's that they're able to have a vision of what they're trying to do. And part of having a vision is being able to tell the story. I know that when I sit with clients and do financial plans, I ask them to tell me what's going on. And it's very rare that someone says, well, Doug, you know, I spent $400 this month on my car lease and I have my mortgage. They talk more in big pictures about their kids and about their retirement and about the family. And by looking at real human life, I think that's how you can then work backwards and figure out what investments you need. Because frankly, the investments are not the hardest part of all this. It's just figuring out what the story is of your life and how you want to lead your life and what kind of legacy you actually ultimately want to leave as a result of doing all this. One of the ways I think that people leave a legacy or get themselves in a lot of trouble is when they dig themselves into a lot of debt. Me here was speaking about different types of debt. And frankly, he seemed to be pretty negative about debt, except in cases of education and buying a home. And I think a lot of people even speak negatively about taking on a lot of debt for education. Linda, let's start with you. Are you pro-debt when you need to use the money for something like that, or do you think you should save up before you actually buy something?
Well, I think you should save up before you buy something for sure, because that's consumer debt. And that is often credit card debt, which is 17% plus interest rates, which is ridiculous to spend that kind of money and pay interest on something that's especially a depreciating asset. I do think that debt gets a bad rap in that it gets painted with this broad brush that all debt is bad. I don't think debt at 3% is bad. You know, my friend called me the other day, said, I want to buy a house. Should I finance it or pay cash? I said, you know, what can you borrow at? He said 3.5%. I said, well, why wouldn't you? I mean, when interest rates are 7% someday, are you going to look back and kick yourself you didn't borrow money at 3.5%? It's just it's the price of money. And when the price of money is that low, as long as he's doing it in a conservative way, and I said, don't borrow to the max in case prices go down on homes and this is a peak, but, you know, do use money as a tool. And I think the main thing is to use debt for appreciating assets, that when you can use debt for a business or debt for rental real estate or something like that, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, specifically now that interest rates are so low and debt is so cheap. But I do think credit cards are where people get in trouble. I think buying things on cards when you don't have the money, and it's especially, you know, something that's going to be worth less and less and less over time, is just a losing game.
I think there's 101 and I think there's 201 concepts when it comes to money. And I think just starting early, getting your feet wet with investing, with learning how to save money, I think that's 101. I think debt is much more of a 201 thing, because I totally agree with Linda that it's not as black and white as just, you know, buying a house or an education. It might be starting a business. There's times when it makes sense for businesses to use other people's money. And, you know, playing the credit card rewards game is horrible for somebody that doesn't understand how to use debt. But I think that it's having a healthy appreciation for the fact that you're going to now owe somebody else money, and a healthy appreciation for having strategy ahead of time about how you're going to pay that debt back that you need to have before you start playing the debt game.
There's also this strategy that people talk about, which is you shouldn't pay off debt early. A lot of times people who are anti-debt, they say, you know, pay down your mortgage quickly and then begin to save. But the problem is it could take you 10, 15 years to pay it down. By that time, you're 45 or 50, at which point you're going to start saving for retirement and you've missed out on all the benefits of compound interest. I'm not sure the math totally works out on that argument, but Miranda, tell me, is this an argument that you see some logic to, that maybe people should focus more on investing when they're young so they can invest for a longer term and then deal with the debt as time goes by?
Yeah, I mean, I can see some value in that. And actually, I did this. I started investing in my retirement before all of my credit card debt was paid off, you know, like 10, 11, 12, I don't know, like a decade or more ago. But even though I still had credit card debt, and Linda's right. I mean, when you're looking at this stuff, you want to look at the interest rates and kind of balance that out and everything. And it may not have been the smartest thing that I've ever done, but I did. I said, you know, really, I just want to get in the habit of investing and building up my nest egg for the future. And I started, it was a very small amount. It was $50 a month. That's what I felt like I could invest in my Roth IRA at the time. And I just started investing in that retirement because I knew that, you know, I'd be investing for, you know, 30, 40 years before I touched the money. And I did, you know, want to start that retirement savings habit. It was just a small amount. And I still, the bulk of my extra money still went toward paying down the high interest credit card debt. But I did want to do both of those goals at the same time. And I wanted to get in a mindset and in an area where I was like, okay, here are the priorities in my life. And I want to make sure that I am living according to my values and my long-term goals. And one of those long-term goals is making sure that I have my tax-advantaged retirement account. You know, I'm contributing to it. And so it was more of a, all right, so even though it's not a whole ton of money, it's about the habit. And as I paid down credit card debt, as my income increased, And I had already established that habit and knew that retirement savings was my goal and making sure my Roth IRA was funded was my goal and my priority. I was able to shift those funds over and add more because, yeah, $50 a month, let's be honest, at even in your mid-20s, $50 a month is not going to fund your retirement. It's not. It's just not. You know, when you invest it.
Right, but it's
helped. But it helps.
It's a start.
But it helps. It's a start. It gets you going and it's the habit. And so if you got $50 a month is not going to make a huge dent in your credit card debt. But, you know, over time, invested over time and sitting there and earning compound interest over time, it might have a nice big cumulative effect. And then once again, it starts that habit. And as you pay off your debt, you can start transferring more money over toward that investing and making it even more effective.
Mm-hmm. And Miranda, I think you're right on target, and that's brilliant. And if everyone would do that, you know, our financial picture in this country would be completely different. If everyone started a $50 a month investment program, it would look completely different.
Yeah, totally different.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, you know, it's not gonna be enough to retire. I don't think that $50 a month when you're 25 is gonna save your retirement. But it's about the mindset. It's about establishing that priority and saying, hey, this is important to my finances and my future. And I'm going to establish that this, and as my financial situation changes, because I've established this priority, I can shift my resources as they become available.
Well, and I think that mindset shift can't be overstated, because I think that it completely changes the game, Miranda, from can I do it, right? But when you're not saving anything at all, the whole conversation's around, can I save? And once you jump that hurdle, and now you're on, can I save more? And how can I save more? Once you put that word more in there, that's when it really starts to get exciting.
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely.
Linda, let me touch on something that you mentioned before. You were talking about borrowing money to buy an appreciating asset. So that would be not to buy a car, but to buy a house. Hopefully your house goes up in value. One of the big debts that a lot of people have is for college education. And I know there are both sides of this, but one of the problems I think that people have is they get so excited that they get into a good school that's going to cost them $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $60,000 a year. And they say, yeah, but it's going to pay off, you know, pays to borrow the money. It's almost like an appreciating asset. I'm investing in myself, and then I'll make a lot more money when I get out. I certainly can think of a lot of young people I know who went to top schools and they're no way making back the money that they borrowed and the amount of money they invested. Is it a smart investment, or do you think that people can go to, you know, some more normally priced school and do just as well?
Well, my parents taught me a very specific lesson about college, and I'll share that with you in a minute. But what I found is that having a college degree was the important thing. It didn't matter where I went. Most people didn't even ask what my degree was in, although it was business. And it was just a matter of having the degree. And that separated me from other job applicants so that I could get certain jobs that they can't get. So I think the important thing is to have the degree. I don't think the school really matters in terms of how much better you're going to do in very rare circumstances. Maybe if you go to Harvard or, you know, maybe Stanford, but very rare circumstances that the college would really matter. My parents taught me that it was funny when I graduated from high school, I had very good grades and I wanted to go to Stanford, and we lived in Washington State, and it wasn't like I really wanted to go, but it was like, oh, hey, you know, it'd be kind of cool to go there. And my mom said, you know, we have five children and we've had three in college at once for a while, and you're going to go and you're going to graduate in 4 years. We'll pay for 4 years. If you take longer, you'll pay for it after that. We'll pay for four, and we'll pay for an in-state school. And that's what they did. And so I graduated exactly in 4 years. That degree has been great, but we didn't get into a huge amount of debt. I think parents spending $250,000 on college is an enormous mistake for them, because it's really giving up some of their retirement savings that is crucial for them. And for the children, like you said, they get into massive debt, or they just really don't get back the money that they invested in that.
So, Joe, how do you feel about that with kids who just finished school, right?
Well, the only way, I think I totally agree with Linda. I think the only time that the name brand, you know, school matters when she talks about Stanford or Harvard maybe is when it comes to networking and who you surround yourself with. And I find that maybe there's a better professor there that can teach you more about life and about, to Linda's degree, more about business opportunities at those schools. And the networking that you do, that you can do at those schools, you look at how, you know, one person had, well, as an example, Bill Gates' roommate was Steve Ballmer. So it's no, it's kind of funny that Ballmer ran Microsoft for a number of years. Why? Bill Gates had a very comfortable relationship with him because they lived together, for goodness sake. So rubbing elbows with other people that are in a similar program. But you have to appreciate that. And the frustration that I see is if somebody attends a school like a Harvard and they don't appreciate the fact that it's about networking or it's about finding that right professor that can change your trajectory, you're going to end up, like Linda said, spending a lot of money for nothing. The school, I think, actually is the one that's kind of different. And I know this from visiting there and from interviewing people that went there, really isn't Harvard at all. I think it's MIT. I think MIT has just such a different feel as a school. I mean, there are a lot of people that go to MIT are just on a completely different wavelength. And I think a lot of MIT stuff is changing the world.
So Miranda, you've got a kid who's not so far away from school. Are you going to encourage him to get himself heavily into debt? Or are you going to break out your retirement savings and break the bank to pay for him to go to some fancy schmancy school?
Yeah. So now the funny thing is my son and I have been talking about his school situation, what he likes, what he enjoys as a person, and his sort of attitude and everything else. And honestly, we had a local tech school, just barely got upgraded to a community college. He has concurrent enrollment options here, and actually as a ninth grader right now, he is concurrently enrolled in Spanish. And so he's already receiving college credit as a ninth grader. You know, honestly, he'll be pretty close to his associate's degree potentially by the time he finishes high school. And if he's not, he can finish up at the community college. And he is actually, he does well in school. He gets A's and B pluses and he does really well in school, but he doesn't like it. He's more of a hands-on person. He's more interested in like robotics and like lab tech type stuff and doing like hands-on things and electronics. And so honestly, I fully expect that he is more likely to pick a school that's not that expensive anyway. But, you know, I've been saving for a 529 for him since he was six. And right now the balance is pretty close to $14,000. You know, that's not enough to get him 4 years of school, but it's, you know, with the things he's doing now, with the planning he's doing, you know, to try and get some scholarships, and with the fact that he's in concurrent enrollment and working on college credit right now, that 14,000, which will be more than 14,000 4 years from now. So, I mean, it's going to grow still. Well, he'll have a pretty good chunk. I will not have to raid my retirement. I mean, I'm pretty sure I will be not having to raid my retirement. And he also understands that he's also expected to help pay for part of his schooling. So he may actually have to get a little bit of debt, but I doubt very highly it will be enough to cripple him.
So you won't have to be doing the Money Tree podcast well into your 70s and 80s is what you're saying.
Well,
we'll be able to
retire. You know, not being forced to, but of course I want your lovely company for decades to come.
Miranda, I think that's so smart to get college credit early. That's a really good move and a smart move for a lot of our listeners, hopefully, to take with
their
kids.
And I think one of the keys here too is I'm not looking at my son and pushing him to try and get this fancy degree from a fancy college doing something he doesn't want to do. We have this idea that, you know, we all want our kids to be doctors. We want our kids to be lawyers. We want our kids to be, you know, maybe be a college professor. We want them to do these like jobs. And we think that everybody needs to go and have a liberal arts degree. And my son is a prime example of somebody who is a smart, studious kid who's getting great grades in school, and he is just not interested in doing the traditional college game where he gets a liberal arts degree and he does school forever. He wants to do something that he thinks is fun and cool and do robotics lab and do that, and he doesn't need a four-year degree for that. And he may decide to get an engineering degree. I don't know. I mean, he's 15, for heaven's sake. You know, I mean, how many times did the rest of us change our majors when we got to college? But the reality of the situation is this idea that we have to either live through our kids and, you know, pay out the nose for them to get these things. So because my son graduated from Harvard and I may be in debt for the rest of my life because I paid for my son to go to Harvard, but I can say my kid went to Harvard. You know, I think part of it is looking at it and say, well, nurture your child, figure out what they want to do and go from there.
Yeah. And don't spend all that money. Listen, you have to remember, what do you call the guy who was in the lowest 10 percentile of his medical school class?
Doctor.
Exactly.
Doctor, right? So it doesn't really matter where you are or what your grades are. It goes to what Linda was saying, which is getting an education is useful, but I don't think it matters so much. In fact, one of the things, Joe, what you had said, which I thought you were about to dive into, is you said probably the best school for people to go to. And what I was going to say is the school of experience, because I find a lot of times I get resumes all the time in my financial planning practice. People want to come work for me and they show me their schooling and then they got an MBA and they figure, okay, if I have an MBA, then I can probably, you know, tell everyone how to manage their money. And I think these people have no concept of what real life is like. And it helps so much for people to go out and work. And if you're in school, having a job while you're in school is a good idea. Taking a year or two off before you go to school or more in order to figure out what you like doing. I often tell people that if you want to impress me with what you learned, you know, as you're coming to get a job, tell me all the online courses that you took, and then we'll talk about them. Having the degree that you got from some school, it's really, they just charged you a heck of a lot of money so that you can walk around and be branded, say, oh, I have the Harvard brand or the Brandeis brand or the Stanford brand or whatever school you want to say. And I'm not sure that means as much as what kind of person you are, and are you a dedicated type of person who likes to learn and who can talk about what he learned and not just show off that you got accepted to a good school, because it also doesn't show that you necessarily did anything so great while you were there. I see this is actually a pretty emotional topic because we all have been involved in one way or the other, and it's very expensive. It is a big financial question about not only whether to go to school, but which school to go to.
You know, Doug, one thing I want to add is that I like the trend of a few schools starting an entrepreneurial program. I think that's so important. And going forward, I think it's going to be more and more important as we have the internet and people can use computers and online-based things to create businesses. I just think it's a really important trend. And I like hearing that there's some education around that. I think that's quite useful.
Yeah, I think that's super. All right. You know, a number of people who are particularly entrepreneurial are the panelists of the Money Tree Investment Podcast. So as we're wrapping up, let's see what some of these entrepreneurs are doing in their business. Let's start with you, Joe. Joe Saul Sehi at Stacking Benjamins. What entrepreneurial thing are you doing these days?
We're operating a podcast every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It's incredibly entrepreneurial. And someday it'll actually go somewhere.
Yeah, you'll have a real office, like not in your
right.
mom's basement.
Right.
Nice.
What are you talking about, man? You just won a Plutus Award for best podcast. I mean, you won a podcast movement. You won a FinCon. You are like Stacking Benjamins. This is your time, man.
Apparently, I owe somebody $20 somewhere. I haven't figured out who yet. Going to have to figure that out.
And if someone wanted to find this Stacking Benjamins podcast, where would he go?
Wherever finer podcasts are found. If you just go to the player you're listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast on and put in Stacking Benjamins, you'll find us there. Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Nice. And Linda P. Jones, how often do you do Be Wealthy and Smart?
I podcast 3 times a week.
Wow.
And they're shorter podcasts, so they're easy to listen to. And the most recent one is 3 Mistakes to Avoid When Investing. You can find that at lyndapjones.com or, as Joe said, wherever you're listening to podcasts, just put in Be Wealthy and Smart.
And Miranda, how about you? How often do you get on the air?
Yeah, so I actually want to kind of do a little plug for the Plutus Awards. The winners were just announced a couple weeks ago at FinCon. And if you want to check out some great podcasts, some great financial blogs, some great places to find financial advice, head on over to www.plutusawards.com. Look at our 8th annual Plutus Awards winners list, and you will find an amazing array of people who can help you make better financial and investing decisions.
Okay. And at GoldsteinOnGelt.com, we are on twice a week, which is a lot of fun. It turns out, in fact, it's a lot of work because every one of the shows I've got a guest on. I like a big part of the show is bringing on the guests and talking to cool people, not the least of which are people who have won Nobel Prizes. In fact, most of the people who won the Nobel Prize in economics who are still alive have been a guest on the show. What's really funny about this is you don't usually win the Nobel Prize until like literally 20, 30, or 40 years after the research you did. So by that time, you're way, way too old to enjoy it. But that you can check out at goldsteinungelt.com. And let's check out of the Money Tree podcast with the help of Miranda Marquardt.
Thanks so much for listening this week. We hope that you will subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, and on Stitcher, and get the latest episodes of the Money Tree podcast delivered straight to your device of choice every single Friday morning. We are excited to have you ask your questions. We've got a listener question episode coming up pretty soon. It's been a while since we've done one, and we miss you. We miss your listener questions. So please send them in. Head on over to MoneyTreePodcast.com and you will find a contact form where you can ask your questions. Also on MoneyTreePodcast.com, you can see all of the episodes that we've had so far, plus get links to great resources and learn more about how to better manage your money and investments. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at MoneyTreePodcast.com for more free investing resources.
Hey, I have a question. Is my microphone correct?
Yeah.
Do I sound far away? Okay.
No, you sound good.
All right.
It sounds like you're not answering my question.
Yeah. No, I'm trying to stall for time.
I asked you about that.
Yes.
I'm just joking. You sound great.